But no, yeah, the Olympics starting this week, and London 2012, I'm sure one of the things that you may have heard, like one of the key words like buzzing around with London 2012 has been the word legacy. We're talking about the Olympic legacy. It's been a real like central theme of the Olympics and the bid, like Adam said this morning. And that also happens to be the theme of today's talk, because we are actually today the last talk in our David series. As the series, we come to the end of David's life, and so the theme and the title of today's talk is legacy. And we may, over the summer, do a few like epilogues and look at some stories that we couldn't fit into the series over the summer. But today, we come to the end of David's life and the end of the series and the story in that way. And so, yeah, the key is legacy. And when we think of legacy, we often think of it, you know, almost like today, how we're looking at it at the end of David's life. And we can think about it as some, you know, at the end of a person's life, isn't it, when we think of someone's legacy. But I was watching a talk by Bill Hybels a little while ago as part of the internship, and he was talking about our legacy. And he was saying how, you know, as people, we live in different places and are part of, you know, different jobs and different streets, different houses, and we don't always stay in the same place, you know, for all of our lives. Like, if I think of myself, you know, I'm 22, but I've lived in two different cities, four or five different houses, you know, been through school, been through uni, played for maybe three different football teams, a few different like jobs and things. So, you know, already in my life, I've been in like lots of different places where I've said like spent like a considerable amount of time. And in those different places, the places that we're in life, we have an opportunity to leave a legacy in those different areas as well. It's not just something, you know, at the end of someone's life, but in all the different places that we find ourselves, whilst we're there, we have an opportunity to build and to leave a legacy. And a legacy, the way we're going to be looking at it is thinking about it as the footprints that you make in a place whilst you're there, in the place that you're in, and the impact that you have whilst you're there, so that something lasts after you've gone. So it's what you build whilst you're there, when you're in the place, so that there's something lasting once you've left. And this is something that has been like a real key theme with the London Olympics. And the whole bid, one of the key things that won them the bid was this promise of leaving an Olympic legacy. And if you go on the London 2012 website, they got a whole website dedicated to the legacy of London 2012 and what it's going to be. And Seb Coe, in the bid for the Olympics, this is one of the things he said: creating a lasting legacy for London and the UK has been the heart of our vision for the Games from day one. Delivering lasting benefits for future generations all around the country, long after the final race has been won. And so we see with the Olympics and with Seb Coe, they're looking to build a legacy from day one. And that is in, you know, their vision right from the beginning. And so today, as we look at the end of David's life, we're going to be looking at his legacy and thinking about, you know, what is a legacy? What does that look like? And how can we create a legacy? What can we learn from David's life in building a legacy and legacies in our own lives in the places that we're in? So first of all then, if we pick up the story from where we left it off previously, and David now is an old man, very frail, about 70 years old, in bed, and as an old man, and this is in 1 Kings chapters 1 and 2, and he's an old man, and it says that he was so old and frail that he couldn't keep himself warm anymore. And we used to have a joke up here in the office with Jenny and Tim, that Jenny has the worst warmth management control I have ever come across. She just cannot retain any heat at all. And as part of the internship training, we'd have, you know, lessons on, like, you know, time management, managing your attitude, managing different things. And we'd always joke with Jenny that she needed a warmth management lesson, because you'd like put the heating on and she'd warm up, but then as soon as it was turned off, she'd be freezing for days again. And Tim had a similar problem, so he invested in what he called his Warmatron, which was basically this massive fleece that you would just wear around all the time. And it was literally, if you put it on, you would be boiling within like 10 minutes. So he would share that around with the team. But unfortunately, you know, for David in those days, he didn't have Warmatrons. So instead, some of his advisors came to him and said, you know, you can't keep warm. Let us go out and find a young girl who will come and care for you, and she can lie in your arms and she can keep you warm. And so that's what they did. They searched the whole of the nation and they found a young, beautiful girl, And the Bible has some interesting names sometimes, so I'll shorten her name to Abby. And they found this young, beautiful girl called Abby, and she came and she cared for David, and she would lie in his arms and keep him warm. And it wasn't like it wasn't a sexual relationship. It was like social care. She was looking after him, caring for him in his old age. And when we think of this as well, it kind of reveals what sort of we've seen the position of women throughout like David's life and throughout this time, how in some ways they would really play a vital role, you know, in the life of David and what we've seen. We saw last week with Shan, didn't we, about the wise woman who saved a whole city by speaking up. And here this girl, Abby, she plays a pivotal role in David's life, caring for him in his old age. And also she's an instrument for political maneuvering later on, but we'll come to that a bit later. But at the same time, we see how, you know, women at the same time sometimes were just used by men for what they could offer. And some, you know, this was a real like male warrior kind of man dominated society. And Abby really here kind of fills the role of like a human water bottle in some ways, you know, which obviously, you know, it isn't a good thing. And, you know, sometimes the view and the perception of women at that time, you know, wasn't a good thing. But nonetheless, many stood up and played a pivotal role at that time. And that's important to see. So this is where David is. He's an old man in bed being kept, you know, alive and cared for by this girl, Abby. And David, there's a bit of a scheme that goes on now behind David's back by his next eldest son, Adonijah. And Adonijah was the second born after Absalom, who we looked at the last 2 weeks, who led a revolt against David. And Adonijah was his next youngest brother. And in many ways, his character was just like Absalom. And if you've seen the film Gladiator, it reminds me of the villain in that, Commodus. If you haven't seen it, it's a great film. And it reminds me of him. His character, he was very boastful, he was self-promoting, and it says he went around saying, I'm going to make myself the next king. And he went around boasting about this. And he was a tall man, very handsome, just like his brother Absalom. But the key thing that we see is that he was never disciplined. It says this in 1 Kings 1, verse 6. Now his father, King David, had never disciplined him at any time, even by asking, why are you doing that? And so he was never disciplined. And really, David kind of reaps what he sows in this situation. In Proverbs 19, verse 20, it says this, discipline your children while there is hope, otherwise you will ruin their lives. And David failed to discipline Adonijah, and in many ways, he ruined this young man's life, and he caused great trouble for himself too. And, you know, thinking back when I was a child, I remember being disciplined on, you know, several occasions. But looking back now, I do really appreciate, you know, the discipline that I've had as, you know, as a child and how that has, you know, shaped like my life and my attitude. And I really appreciate it. I remember once when I was 6 or 7 and some relatives had come all the way down from Exeter to visit us as a family. And it was just my parents and me in the house at the time. And I remember as they were leaving, they were trying to say goodbye, you know, to my parents and me. And I was just like sitting, playing with some like Thomas the Tank trains, I think, just like completely ignoring them. And they were like trying to say, oh, you know, goodbye, Matthew, you know, we'll see you again. And I was just back to them, like just not interested, playing with these trains. And so they left. And then I remember straight after that, my mum, she took me aside once they'd gone. And she said, you know, Matthew, the way that you behaved then was really rude to, you know, Uncle Martin and Auntie Jan. They'd come all the way down to Exeter to see you. And, you know, what you did then was really rude. And ever since then, I remember that so vividly. And ever since then, I've tried to, you know, whenever saying goodbye to someone, to make that effort to, like, say goodbye in a good way, whether it's, you know, seeing them to the door or handshake or, you know, whatever it is. But just to make that effort to value a person and the time that you've spent with them. And, to, you know, to show them that value. And that's something I still remember now and try to do. And I trace it all the way back to that moment when I was, you know, disciplined as a child. Or I remember another time when I was a little bit older, maybe about 10 or 11. And my parents and Tammy and some others in the church used to run a Friday club in my old junior school. So I used to go along to that. There's this one particular week where Tammy was running the club and I was just being really disruptive, just like really naughty, I don't know why, I can't remember, but I just remember playing up, being like really familiar, causing all sorts of havoc. I remember towards the end of the club getting a look from my mum and knowing at that moment, oh, I'm in trouble here. And when I got home, you know, she gave me a telling off. I remember her, you know, explaining to me how my behavior and being so naughty and disruptive, not only was it disrespectful to Tammy, but it was also, you know, obstructing all the other children's enjoyment of the club and to be able to hear about Jesus and how, you know, what my behavior was doing. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that again. And so, you know, Tammy's not here today, but Zeno, you can send her my apologies, you know, from sincerest apologies. But, you know, I remember that even then. And, you know, I'm really grateful for the discipline that I had as a child and, you know, how it's of great value. And in Psalm 119, verse 67, sorry, I've gone too many, it says this, I used to wander off until you disciplined me, but now I closely follow your word. And when the psalmist writes that, I really think he's saying that from like a grateful heart, you know, that he's thanking God for that discipline. I used to wander off, but now I follow closely your word. And that, when I read that, it sounds to me like it's coming from a grateful heart. And, you know, discipline, like it says, it's important, isn't it? And it makes all the difference. But David, you know, he had failed to discipline his son, Adonijah. And now Adonijah, he betrays his own father. And he tries to make himself king. And what he does, first of all, he copies what his older brother Absalom had done. So he hires 50 men and some chariots, and he gets them to run in front of him to make himself look kingly. And he copies him. And then the next thing he does is he gets some people on his side. And firstly, he goes to Joab. And we all know about Joab. We've seen a lot about him, you know, over the course of, you know, this series, how he's the commander of the army, a great warrior, but really driven by self-interest and a bit of a dangerous man as well. And I was reading just yesterday that when he died and they buried him, it said they buried him in his home in the wilderness. So even his home was in the wilderness. Like, this guy was, you know, a bit of a madhead. But he was fierce. So anyway, he gets Joab on his side, and Joab was the commander of the army. And my history teacher always used to say, whoever controls the army controls the country. So this is really dangerous. So Adonijah gets Joab on his side, and then he also gets Abiathar on his side. And Abiathar was a priest who'd been without David throughout the whole of his reign and, you know, the majority of his life. And he gets Abiathar, the priest, on his side as well. And Abiathar was one of David's advisors too. Not only does he get them on his side, but he says he took them into his confidence. So he got them on his side in secret, behind David's back, moving into, you know, acting in secret. And then the next thing he does, once he's got these two key figures on his side, is he throws a big celebration. And he takes them to En-Rogel, which is just outside of Jerusalem there, and that's it in the modern day. And he takes them outside and he throws this big celebration as he tries to make himself king, and he performs sacrifices and things. And it says that all of the royal officials and all of his brothers, so all of David's sons, were invited to this celebration, except for a key few. So everyone's invited, all the royal officials, all the brothers, except for David, first of all, wasn't invited. Solomon, who was David's choice to be the next king, God's choice to be the next king, he was excluded. Nathan the prophet. And Nathan, he'd been alongside David, and whenever David was making a key decision, he would often consult with Nathan the prophet. Like when he was thinking of building the temple, he went to Nathan, you know, I want to build a temple for the Lord, you know, and Nathan would consult God for David on his behalf. So a very close person with David. So Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the captain of David's bodyguard, probably the warrior closest to David, his personal protection, someone very loyal, he was excluded. And Zadok the priest, someone else who'd been with David throughout most of his reign and would work alongside Abiathar. And these people were all excluded from this party. And this group of people were like essentially David's leadership team. And you know what Adonijah was doing? Like, this wasn't just like a meal or a celebration or a get-together, but this was a political maneuvering behind David's back. And all the people who would have recognized what was going on here and what this meeting was about and would have said, hold on a minute, you know, does David know about this? Is this what David's, you know, said? All those who would have known about that were excluded from this meal. And so much so that the key phrase in this part of the story is when Nathan the prophet hears about what's going on, and he runs to Bathsheba, who's Solomon's mother and David's wife, and he explains to her what's going on. He says, you know, Adonijah, he's taken these people into his confidence, he's thrown this party, he's making himself king, and David doesn't even know about it. It was all in secret behind David's back. And Adonijah was bypassing David's and God's authority to choose the next successor, to choose who would be king. He was bypassing this, doing it behind his back. He was, in effect, like betraying his own father. And so a lesson to learn for us from this, talking about the life lessons, first of all, is like if we find ourselves like in a social setting, whether it be in like work or in like a football team or in family or whatever, and certain people are like deliberately excluded in this way, there's like a strong like pattern to it, and you can, you know, like in this circumstance, then alarm bells should be going really, and we want to ask, you know, is something else going on here that I don't really know about? I remember when I was at university, when I went into my second year, I was asked to take over a football team and to run it. And so I was running this team, but there was some third years in the team who'd obviously been there a year longer than I had. And between trainings midweek and a match on a Saturday, sometimes they would get together and they'd have their own like meeting, and they would pick the team together and put themselves all in like the best positions that they wanted to play in. And then they would try and like inform me and the rest of the team of what the team was going to be, you know, for the match. And several times I'd have to like stand up to this and be like, no, boys, you know, we'll be picking the team or what's best for the team, not just, you know, their like third years meeting together. And this, you know, a similar thing here is, you know, going on in David's life. It's something behind his back. And in this case, you know, there was a reason why these five key people were excluded. And that's because, you know, it was behind David's back. It was a challenge to God's authority. It was a scheme without any kind of permission. And fundamentally, it was wrong. And that's why, you know, they were doing it in secret. And that's another lesson for us to learn, really, is that to be wary of doing things in secret. You know, be wary of doing things in secret. Jesus said, didn't he, that what is done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops, and what is done in secret comes to light. And as Christians, we want to align our lives with Jesus, don't we, and be more like him and what he said. And I love it when, well, I don't love it, but when Jesus stood before Pilate on his trial in John 18, and Pilate was asking him and questioning him, what are you about, Jesus? This is what he said. Actually, I came into the world to testify to the truth. All who love truth recognize that what I say is true. What a fantastic thing that Jesus says about loving the truth. And don't we want to be people who love truth? Such a simple thing, isn't it? But to be people who live truthful lives and to be known as lovers of truth. I want to be someone who loves truth and to make that a principle of, you know, the life that I live. And so David, as you know, Jesus says, these things come to light, and it does come to light, and David hears about it. And so what is his response? Well, he hears about what's going on, and immediately he acts. And he acts in the authority that he has as king. And he calls in Benaiah, the bodyguard, and he calls in Zadok, the priest, and he calls in Nathan, the prophet, and he says, take my son Solomon down to this particular spring, and I want you to take him down on my own mule, which spoke of like the king's authority, and that, you know, David, this was his action, and anoint him king there. And so they do that, and they anoint Solomon king, and then Solomon returns, and he sits on David's throne. And it says that all the city joined in and celebrated and followed Solomon and were shouting, you know, long live King Solomon and all that kind of stuff. And it says the celebration was so joyous and noisy that the earth shook with the sound. Like the whole city was like, you know, going for it. You imagine like when you go past the Liberty Stadium and Swansea score and you can like hear it. That is what I'm imagining is going on here. And so everyone can hear it. And just a few miles away at Adonijah's meal, he's sitting around there with all his guests, and they can hear all this kind of commotion as well. And Joab asks, you know, what's going on? What's all that noise? And then a messenger comes in and says, you know, Solomon has been anointed king, and David has anointed him. And as soon as they hear that, Adonijah's guests all scatter, and they run away, because they know, you know, this is dangerous. And so, you know, a few of those guests, Adonijah, you know, he'd invited all the royal officials, all of the brothers, and a few of those may have just been like innocent victims as part of that meal. And as soon as they recognized what had gone on and that this wasn't something sanctioned by David, they left immediately and they wanted, you know, to get away. And it reminds me of a few weeks ago when we saw that Stephen Furtick DVD and he was talking about only God can send the rain, isn't it? How for all of our planning and preparation that we do, you know, only God can really make things happen and have, you know, great effect. He was using the example of when the Israel were going to war and they ran out of water and were saying for all of their preparation and planning, you know, only God could make it rain. And it's the same here. You know, Adonijah, he's got all this scheming, all this planning, trying to put something together. And then on the other hand, David just gets three people to anoint Solomon king. And who do all the crowd respond to? They respond to Solomon because it had like God's, you know, seal of approval in this case. And, you know, it's one of those examples where only God can send the rain. And all the city and everyone followed Solomon and David. And so to summarize the story so far then, Adonijah, he fails in his bid to get the crown. Solomon is now anointed king and sitting on David's throne. And Adonijah, when he hears about what's going on, he runs to the altar and kind of makes a plea that Solomon will spare his life. And Solomon says, if Adonijah proves himself faithful, then he won't be harmed and I will spare his life. And Solomon, acting out of his like rightful place and the security that he had as king, because he had been anointed by, you know, God and by David, out of the security he had that that was his rightful place, he was able to spare Adonijah's life. Whereas had it been the other way around and Adonijah was king, no doubt he would have got rid of Solomon and got rid of the competition. But Solomon, out of the security of his rightful position, you know, spared him and showed mercy. And so Solomon is now king and he's sitting on the throne and David's an old man. And David gives him some advice from the old king to the new king, father to son. And he gives him advice and this is what he says, take courage and be a man. That's his advice to Solomon. What great, like, short, simple advice, isn't it, to a new king from a father to son. And he's saying to him, you know, be brave. Like, don't wimp out of doing what's right. If I think of what could the opposite of this be, it would be to, like, wimp out. And a wimp, by definition, is a weak and cowardly or unadventurous person. And the interesting thing about this is that David and Solomon were two different characters with two very different gifts. We've seen throughout David's life, he was a real warrior, wasn't he? He was someone that would fight lions with his bare hands. He beat Goliath. He would lead the army into battle. He was like, you know, a macho man, a warrior. Solomon, on the other hand, he was a thinker, a philosopher, a wise man, not the kind of macho warrior type like David was. And so when David gives this advice, take courage and be a man, he's not talking about like the physical aspect. It's not like a macho man thing. He's not saying, you know, take out your sword and like be a warrior. It's not in that kind of physical, you know, battling sense. It's to do with character, Solomon's resolve, his attitude, responsibility, showing patience, these different character aspects. That way he's saying, take courage and be a man in this way. And that's why it applies to men and women as well. This isn't like a masculine thing. This is like a character lesson for men and women. Responsibility, attitude, character. And 2 weeks ago at the Wimbledon final, I don't know if you saw the final, but I don't know if you saw just before the final, there was another kind of young man with the whole eyes of a nation on him under lots of pressure, similar to David and Solomon, David Beckham, who was asked a very provoking question from a journalist about him being excluded from the Great British Olympic football team. And the journalist said to him, you know, on live TV, you must be really disappointed, you know, to be excluded. How do you feel about it? And obviously, everyone's watching this and, you know, Beckham has to choose how he responds. And he showed great character in his response. Instead of focusing on the personal and the negative and his own disappointment, he said, the Olympics is a great opportunity for us as a nation to join together in unity and to celebrate and support our team, and I will be getting behind them. And he saw the bigger picture, and he showed great character in his answer. And he could have said anything. And when it flipped back to Sue Barker, who was in the studio, even she commented that how that was a very gracious answer that he gave. And David Beckham here, he showed great character. And And so for us, this lesson, you know, take courage and be a man, it's a challenge for our lives, isn't it? You know, not being weak in our decision-making, making those right choices, being brave, taking courage, standing up for what we know is right. A few weeks ago, we were at the New Wine Wales conference, and there was a guy speaking there, and he was a top businessman from New Zealand. And he was sharing this story how he was on this particular board, and they had a board meeting. And a few days prior to this meeting, he'd been asked to take over as the chief exec of this company. So he's an important man, you know, on this board. But anyway, they're in this meeting on the board, and the current chairman or CEO or the, you know, person leading the company was sharing a story, telling a story of something that recently had gone on in the company. So something had recently happened, and he was reporting back. And he basically, like, fabricated this story. He, like, changed, you know, what had happened, changed the facts, and retold this story in a way that he would like the story to be known and understood. Does that make sense? So he changed the facts, and basically he was, like, inviting the board to, like, join in with this, like, new version of events. He was sitting there, and he has a choice now. He either just, like, goes along with it and accepts this, like, new truth and this new story, or, you know, he makes a stand and stands up for the real truth. And he said that in the meeting, he stood up, like, physically, and intervened and said, like, hold on a minute, that's not actually what happened, and spoke the truth. And after that, he was sacked from that board. But nonetheless, he stood up for what was true. And in that moment, you know, he took courage. As David said, he took courage, and he was a man, and he stood up for what he knew was right, and he stood up for the truth. And that's a challenge for us, isn't it? To do the right thing, to take courage and be a man. And I think it's a challenge as well in sharing our faith. Take courage and be a man in that as well. And so David, not David Beckham, but King David, he gives this advice to Solomon. And Solomon is now firmly established as king. And after this, David breathes his last and he dies. An old man at peace in his bed with the kingdom secure. So what then, after David has died, what is the legacy that he leaves behind? Well, you know, David, his kingdom was secure, unlike Saul that went into all civil war. When David died, Solomon was firmly established. His dynasty was promised. And David was like the greatest king by which all future kings would be compared. When you read throughout the book of Kings and you see all the kings that came next and next and next, they're all compared to David. For example, there's one king, Abijam, and it says, he was not faithful to the Lord as David had been. Or another king, King Asa. Asa did what was pleasing in the Lord's sight, as his ancestor David had done. And so all future kings are compared with David. He set the benchmark of what a king should do. And his legacy was built over the course of his life. Sometimes people are remembered for some kind of like one historic moment, aren't they? Like, think of like Nelson at Trafalgar. You know, that's how he's remembered, that one historic moment. But even then, like the decisions of the course of his life leads him to that place. David, on the other hand, he didn't go out in some kind of blaze of glory, and he didn't like go out in tragedy like Saul did and leave a legacy that way. But rather, he built his legacy over the course of his life. And as we've seen in this series, yes, David had highs and lows and he made mistakes, but fundamentally, he was a man after God's own heart, wasn't he? That was who he was about, and that's what he built his life on and his kingship on. And in the rest of his advice to Solomon, this is what David said. He said, "Observe the requirements of the Lord your God and follow all his ways. If you do this, then the Lord will keep the promise he made to me. He told me, if your descendants live as they should and follow me faithfully with all their heart and soul, one of them will always sit on the throne of Israel. Follow me faithfully with all their heart and soul." And as we've seen, David was a man after God's own heart, and that's what his legacy was built on throughout his life. And so one key lesson for us to learn then in thinking about a legacy, thinking about the places that we're in and how we can have an impact, is that our legacy, as Seb Coe says, starts from day one. It starts right now. It's not something we like think about at the end or put off to the end, but who we are now will determine like the legacy that we leave. And I love it when Paul in the New Testament is leaving the Ephesian church and he's talking to the Ephesian elders and he gives a bit of a leaving speech and he says, this is what I've been whilst I've been with you. And I haven't, you know, shied away from doing what is right. And this is who I've been. And he's able to say, whilst I was with you, this is who I was. And this is the legacy I'm leaving behind. Because his legacy and what he said at the end was like what he did throughout the time that he was there. And thinking back over the course of this series of David's life and also through the course of history, really, there are different people who stand out, isn't there? Throughout the course of this series, we've noticed different people, haven't we? Different characters who have stood out. And some of them have remained nameless, like the woman Sian talked about last week, and some of them become famous. But sometimes all it takes is one person to stand up and stand out. And each of us, you know, we're in our own worlds and have our own spheres, and each of us, like Adam said this morning, can leave that imprint on the place that we're in. Each of us, we can all do that. That's something we can all do. And we can be, you know, intentional in the places that we're in and think about, what do I want to leave behind? What are the footprints that I want to make? What's the imprint I want to make? And so we can all try, you know, that challenge of not just letting things pass us by, but to also stand up and make a difference and make an imprint in the areas that we're in and being intentional about it. And then the second thing that we learn from David and his legacy is that he ended well. Now, David, he almost held on to the kingship too long. Adonijah almost wrestled it off him at the end because, you know, he was an old man and he hadn't officially handed it over yet. And we all know those phrases, don't we, where it says, like, don't overstay your welcome and leave them wanting more and too much of a good thing. And sometimes we need to know when to end something. And, you know, God has a timing, doesn't he? And certain things have a season. For example, think of Helen and Jeremy, who have been in Africa for the last 8 years or so, but now God has called them back to Wales. And that was a good, you know, what they were doing in Africa was still a good thing, and it was still working and going well, but God had called them back. And so they've had to let go of a good thing, but responded to God in ending it now and responding to that season. And so sometimes God is a season we need to know when to end. On the other hand, though, obviously, things that we're committed to, things that responsibilities we have, we got to remain faithful to those and stick with our responsibilities. And that's what David did. He stayed faithful till the very end, and he fought till the very end to end well. When you think, even on his deathbed, think of David's life and everything that he's gone through, and now he's an old man on his deathbed, you know, relaxing a little bit, and even then there's a challenge to his kingdom, and he has to fight right to the very end to hold on to it and to end well. And so... at the beginning of Solomon's reign, as David hands over, we see a bit of a contrast of endings. David, he remained faithful to the end and fought well. But some of the other characters, they didn't end so well. And a lesson for us is that, thinking, you know, David with his legacy, he built it over the course of his life, didn't he? And it's not always easy to create a legacy right at the end. So, for example, we're all familiar with Darth Vader. You heard of Darth Vader? Now, Darth Vader is like one of the ultimate villains, isn't he, of film, history, and things. When you think of Darth Vader, you think of the music and all that kind of stuff, the Death Star, whatever. But actually, at the end of Star Wars, Darth Vader becomes the hero, and he actually saves, like, Luke Skywalker and saves, like, the whole galaxy. And right at the end, Darth Vader is actually the hero of the whole story. But when we think of Darth Vader and we remember him, we don't think of him as a hero, do we? And it just shows how, you know, a legacy and how the imprint that we have, it can be difficult to create right at the end. That's why we want to start now from day one. But on the other hand, it can easily be lost right at the end. And this is what we see from some of the other characters. First of all, Adonijah. Really, he was foolish. After Solomon had been made king and he'd spared his life, he has another try at trying to get the kingship and trying to wrestle it back. And he requests to marry Abby, the girl who'd been looking after David. And this wasn't like just a, you know, an innocent request. This was like taking the king's authority and the king's, you know, position to ask this. And he still had Joab on his side. He was still very dangerous. And Solomon sees right through it. And he sees that he wasn't being faithful and he was trying to take it off him now that David was dead. And so Adonijah is, you know, put to death by his own doing. Joab as well. We've seen how throughout Joab's life, you know, he betrays David again at the end as well. And, you know, he has a tragic ending too. And then finally, Abitha. And Abitha for me is the real sad character at this story. Solomon, he calls Abitha in, who had joined in this betrayal of David. And this is what Solomon says. "You deserve to die, but I will not kill you now, because you carried the ark of the sovereign Lord for my father David and shared in all his hardships." And Abitha was a person who'd been with David throughout all of his reign. When David first fled from Saul and ran to the cave, that's when Abitha came and joined him and was his priest and was alongside David throughout all of his reign. Throughout all of his hardships, Abitha was there alongside David, loyal. But now right at the end, as David is on his deathbed, he betrays him. And it makes me think when you're reading it, like, why would he do that? Why would he do it then? And, you know, was it like self-interest? Was he trying to secure his own position? I don't know. But all we see is that, you know, he betrays David right at the end. And Solomon removes him from his position of responsibility. His father and his father's fathers, they'd all been priests and served the Lord in that way. But Abitha was removed from that position. And so he literally throws away like his legacy, because now he was the last in his family to serve the Lord in that way, to serve as a priest. And so even though he'd been loyal to David all through his life, right at the end, he throws it all away and he throws away that legacy. And so that's a lesson for us, isn't it? To make sure we end well and be like David and fight and be faithful till the very end and to end well. And so on that note, let's bring this to an end. Let's end well here. So some lessons for us to learn from today and David's legacy. First of all, let's end well and be faithful to the end. Let's love truth. Let's be people who love truth. Be a man and be courageous. And finally, be a man after God's own heart, like David was. And if we do that, then no doubt we'll create a great impact and have an impact on the world that we're in, and we can make a difference. Shall we pray? Father, we thank you for what we can learn in David's life. And Holy Spirit, I pray that you'll come and fill each of us now and help us to live a life that makes a difference, has an impact, Father. And we want to serve you with our lives. Please help us in that, Holy Spirit. Amen.